said he learned the lesson to be more attentive to the internet as a source of information. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
The Iraqi journalist who threw a shoe at former President George W. Bush in December has been sentenced to 3 years in prison. Muntadhar al-Zaidi was convicted of assaulting a foreign leader. Zaidi maintains his action was a natural response to the occupation. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who was there during the shoe incident, says the whole thing was an embarrassment for his country. But much of Iraq and the Middle East consider Zaidi a hero. Here's the latest from Wall Street. Dow continues to gain ground, up 107 points at 7,038. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, opening a digital and print photography space in Los Angeles at annenbergspaceforphotography.org.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting Azwat, a multimedia celebration of the golden age of Arab music on March 15th. More information is available at krannertcenter.com. WILL programming is made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, offering over 30 varieties and blends of whole bean or ground coffee at 24 East Columbia in Champaign. Coffee, tea, and chai are available from their retail store, in local restaurants, and through Columbia Street Roastery's coffee service. More information is available at 352-9713.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. It is not hard to find examples of individuals who seem to be motivated only by self-interest. At the same time, we know that in places all over the world, we find people who are expressing compassion and modesty and awe. And here's the question. Which of these two orientations is more common? Which of them is more fundamental to human nature? Our guest for this hour, psychologist Dacher Keltner, says that human beings are not hardwired for selfishness, as some people think. He says, in fact, that we are hardwired to be good. And that is the idea that he sets out in his book, Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. And it's published by W.W. Norton. And he argues in this book, in part, that in fact, survival may not be a matter of who is the fittest, but who is the kindest. Our guest, Dacher Keltner, is professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley. He's also director for the Greater Good Science Center and co-editor of Greater Good magazine. His research focuses on pro-social emotions, power, and moral reasoning. Professor Keltner, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's great to be here.
Just, I suppose, as a way of starting, we could talk a little bit about the current, metaphorically speaking, against which you are swimming, and that is the fact that for a long time, people in the social sciences have argued, and I think it's become rather firmly established in people's minds, the idea that human beings are fundamentally selfish, aggressive, thinking about themselves, and that in fact it was necessary for human beings to develop things like laws and religion to keep that fundamental tendency in check.
Yeah, well, that's a terrific place to start, David. You know, in the social sciences and evolutionary sciences where I work, our field has really been dominated by a deep set of assumptions about human nature that are old in our culture. And I called those homo economicus. And they are assumptions that homo economicus, or who we are, is selfish at our core, competitive in our basic orientation, and wired to be cynical about other human beings, because all of those tendencies help us in the survival of fittest competition. And regrettably, that view has led to a myopia, or just a very narrow lens upon who we are. And my book, Born to be Good, is an attempt to correct that. Mm-hmm. So just to give you one example, there have been debates about why we act in kind, altruistic fashion when we give to others at the cost to the self. Central debates in our field. And the assumption is that somehow those very kind behaviors come out of our basic self-interest and our wiring to promote our own advantage at the expense of others. When in fact, a simpler interpretation is very simply that evolution has built into us emotions like compassion, parts of the brain, parts of our nervous system that promote generous, kind behavior. And that's really what we're trying to show.
And, you know, I think it's interesting. You know, talked about the fact that people have made and maybe continue to make this argument that a fundamental selfishness, this spirit of competition, wanting to be out for yourself, is a part of the survival of the fittest sort of notion. I guess I could see where that could contribute to the survival of the individual. But actually, I think when you start to think about it, it doesn't take very long before you start thinking, well, that doesn't necessarily contribute to this to the survival of the group. And if that's what you're after, then maybe you would right away say, well, isn't that, you know, selfishness, only thinking for yourself, maximizing your benefits to the expense of everybody else? That's not very good for the whole. And if the whole doesn't survive, well, in the long run, the individual's not going to survive.
Yeah, you put your finger, David, on the exact insight that a lot of people have had in critiquing this self-interest model of human nature, which is that what is the defining characteristic of human beings? And there's a lot of consensus coming out of archaeology and the study of our primate relatives and elsewhere that we are a hyper-social species, right? Mm-hmm. We're not terribly fast. We're not as strong as other primates. We lost our big fangs. We wouldn't do very well in surviving on our own. And just as importantly, we produce these hyper-vulnerable offspring with giant heads that are born prematurely, taking, you know, 7 to 8 to 40 years to reach the age of independence. And so that those basic facts in our hominid evolution really bonded us together as a hyper-social species, and it led to a whole new set of emotions in our evolution that transcend self-interest. Emotions like gratitude, where we build up friendships. Emotions like reverence, where we respect the hierarchy of our group or people within our group. And, of course, emotions like love and compassion. Hmm.
And so is it the basic argument that you're making is if you ask this question, where do particularly these kinds of emotions, pro-social emotions, come from, you would say that they're something that developed as we developed and that the same, that natural selection applies and that people who had those things, that somehow it gave them and their group an advantage?
Absolutely. You know, the great, and this really, your observation makes contact with the great genius of Charles Darwin, whose 200th birthday is coming up. And Darwin said, look, we look at the emotions that are powerful and part of our nervous systems today, emotions like compassion or reverence and respect or modesty, as you said in your introduction. And then you have to trace them back deep in our evolutionary time, hundreds of thousands of years. And when you go back in time and you look at what our groups were like, we've learned a few basic facts, if you will. One, we had to take care of very hyper-vulnerable offspring to make it as a species. And that built up our nervous systems to feel compassion and caretaking. A second one is very fascinating when you sort of trace these emotions back in our evolutionary history is a lot of species solve conflicts territorially, right? Bird species, other kinds of mammals, some primates. But humans didn't have that luxury to separate into small little bands, you know, of two or three or little family units. We had to solve our conflicts face to face. And so we are an amazingly forgiving species. So these basic evolved facets of our social evolution or groupness led to these emotions.
And also you're making the argument that these emotions and then the display of these emotions and the interplay of these emotions between individuals are part of a complex system of communication in which we're working things out with one another, and particularly as an alternative to conflict.
Absolutely. You know, and again, you know, this is one of Charles Darwin's insights, but what we've learned from 20 years of studying emotional expression, the face, the voice, and touch, is that we have evolved, or our particular facial muscles and our hands and our shifting larynx and our vocal apparatus enables us to be amazingly powerful at communicating different emotions, right? Mm-hmm. With half-second vocalizations, I can communicate compassion or gratitude or respect. We did a really funny study where we were interested in touch, and it'd be wonderful to talk more about touch. Mm-hmm. Touch, we have these amazing hands shaped by evolution. We have amazing receptors under the surface of the skin that go right to your brain and help regulate your immune system and process information about rewards. And our research, this is Matt Hertenstein down at DePauw, with a one-second touch to a stranger's forearm, you can communicate emotions like gratitude and compassion at remarkable levels of fidelity. So we solve these social problems of staying together and trusting each other through communication, as you say.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Dacher Keltner. He's professor of psychology at University of California, Berkeley, and his research focuses on pro-social emotions, and that is what we are talking about here this morning. And certainly if you want to read more in greater detail than we'll be able to do, you want to look at his newly published book, Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. It's published by W.W. Norton. And, of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. We've got somebody here we get right in. Not to make them wait, others are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Callers in the community of Belgium, that's line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. With what you say, there's one question that just leaps forward in my mind, and that's why is tribalism and war so prevalent throughout our species?
Yeah. The caller asked, in a way, the most fundamental question, which is, sure, in my day-to-day living, maybe if I live in a healthy, vibrant community or neighborhood, I see, and I talk about this in the book, all these amazing acts of cooperation and generosity. And yet at the same time, you read about, one of the historical incidents that moved me was the genocide in Rwanda and Philip Gurevich's account, and you're astonished at how quickly neighbors and teachers can turn on their loved ones based on tribalism. And the answer is really a couple-fold. One is that we are an amazingly complex mammal that has, in the spirit of Walt Whitman, we are many things, and certainly there's a dark side to human nature. And that's been well worked out by our science in terms of brain regions and neurotransmitters and social behaviors that lead to terrorism and genocide and violence and just an infanticide. But what my book tries to do is say, look, we've thought that was the main story about human nature, but there's this whole other swath of our nervous system that promotes all these good things. And the task of life is that we are constantly in struggle with those conflicting forces.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Perhaps you could turn for a moment here to talk about Darwin. Now, and people, I'm sure, when they think about Darwin, probably one of the first kind of phrases or ideas that does come to mind is survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
And particularly as it has been twisted and not always well served when it's applied to societies and ideas that come under the heading of social Darwinism.
Yeah.
What's really interesting about Darwin, well, among the many things interesting about Darwin, is that he was very interested in emotions and in displays of emotion and in expression, and he was all, for all of the survival of the fittest stuff that people think about, Darwin was actually very interested in these kinds of pro-social emotions that you're interested in.
Wow, David, what a terrific question. It's so fascinating when you mention the name Darwin to people today, even Darwin scholars and even me before I began this book, images like survival of the fittest and bloody and tooth and claw come readily to mind. Well, it turns out those are misrepresentations of Darwin's original thought. Survival of the fittest was a phrase that he did not use originally, and it was promulgated or popularized by Herbert Spencer, who led to social Darwinism. Social Darwinism, the idea that some groups or races are superior to others because of evolution, is not something that Darwin ever wrote about or endorsed, and was a misapplication of his ideas by other people, racist people. And we're now learning that those were horribly wrong in evolutionary thought and social application. Instead, you know, it's amazing to read about Darwin up close, and what a remarkable human being, you know, traveling on the Beagle for 5 years, every day sick, to seasick, and a real struggle for him, is that Darwin was a profoundly nice person. Historians of science have said, of all the great scientists, he's in the top 1 or 2% in terms of treating others with respect. Everybody on the Beagle thought he was, he made friends with the captains and the upper classes and the crew on the Beagle. And in his thinking about human nature, I'll just quote one thing. He said, the strongest of our instincts as humans, the most critical as a product of evolution, is sympathy. So really, I hope this book is part of, along with Adam Gopnik has a wonderful new book out, Angels and Ages, is really a rethinking of who Darwin was and what he thought about human beings.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk with someone else here. This is a caller in Urbana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi there. At one point, I remember that President Clinton, I think he was speaking in Haiti, made the remark that democracy does not arise naturally.
Uh-huh.
Or something close to that, anyway. And, you know, it really struck me in my thinking about that since then, and if the recent problems economically with the folks in the stock market losing their social contract with the
yep.
people they represented, and my understanding of the slave trade and what happened in Britain and Europe and eventually in the United States by way of consciously having to become other than the other, having to become civilized,
yeah,
having to define civilized. It just seems to me that history talks in the reverse of what you're saying. I want what you're saying to be true, by the way, but I just really have trouble seeing it. So, if you want to, Bourdieu said that you had to have ease in order to become civilized, and I wonder about that too sometimes.
Yeah. Wow.
I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Terrific. Well, what a deep question. First of all, with respect to history and where we're going as a species or group, I would heartily recommend Steve Pinker at Harvard has written an essay saying, you know, even when you think about the excesses and immoralities of many of our institutions, right, Jim Crow laws or what happened in the stock market collapse and just the absolute greed and self-interest that led to this current economic condition, Steve Pinker says, as a culture, thanks to certain kinds of institutions like democracy, we are becoming a more peaceful, cooperative species. And the egregious, horrifying acts of violence, infanticide, genocide, historically are declining. So I take heart in that, because like you, like the caller, I do worry about the direction. The other way to think about this is that what my book is about really is about what evolution gave us in the thousands of generations that we evolved in small groups, and the consensus is it produced amazingly powerful, pervasive tendencies toward cooperation, sacrifice, and bringing out the good in others. Jared Diamond makes a very interesting point that culture shifts about 15,000 years ago with the stable acquisition of grains and resources, and that led to institutions and the broadening of culture and collectives where you suddenly saw really pronounced hierarchies, the exploitation of people, and in a way you can think about culture as the struggle between developing institutions that honor our better tendencies. So, you know, regulations of economic markets are going to be a good example of that.
Again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I wanted to give you an opportunity here to make some connections between, you were talking a little bit earlier about Darwin, his interest in emotions,
yeah.
The fact that he was also interested in display of emotions, yeah. and actually went to the extent of trying to catalog, based on his observations of people and I think also of animals, signs that seem to outward signs that seem to line up with inward states,
yeah.
so that he could sort of make some make a catalog. It says, okay, if somebody looks like this, here's what's going on inside. And for apparently for a long time, though, people within the social sciences said, well, you know, this whole business of emotions and what people are experiencing and what they're displaying and what that all means, that that really was all, it was culture specific. You couldn't say anything cross-cultural. And so this gets us to this man who was a mentor of yours, who, interestingly enough, has been in the news lately because of this new TV show that's sort of loosely based on him and his work. This is a Paul Ekman, who is generally, I think, acknowledged to be maybe the world's leading authority on facial expressions.
Yeah.
So tell us about Ekman, particularly in his work, his cross-cultural work on that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, David. What a terrific question. We would not be having this conversation right now were it not for Charles Darwin and then Paul Ekman. Mm-hmm. So Darwin, just to get the story going, he published Origin of the Species, didn't write anything about human beings, and then started facing creationist scientists' attacks of evolution. And one of the attacks was that evolution really can't account for human design or who we are, because we have muscles that really are different from other primates, and therefore that's proof that God designed the human facial musculature. And Darwin wrote this brilliant book on human emotional expression called The Expression of Emotion in Man and Animals, 1872. And like you said, with absolutely painterly and brilliant insight, portrays the emotions of the facial expressions and postural expressions of 30 emotions, which I represent in a table in Born to be Good. Mm-hmm. Regrettably, that amazing contribution wasn't really listened to in our fields until a young scientist came along in the early 60s, Paul Ekman. And Ekman read Darwin, and at the time, the social sciences believed that facial expressions, like languages, were culturally specific, right? Mm-hmm. We have all these muscles, and we put them into different configurations, like the phonemes of a language, to express different emotions. And Ekman took photos of six emotions that Darwin described and went to New Guinea and lived with a hunter-gatherer people for 6 months. And after getting the blessings of the witch doctor, did this research and found that those people in New Guinea, radically different in their culture from you or me, expressed emotion in the same fashion as you or I would, and they judged emotion in the same fashion.
Yeah, so he got some people who were actors, and he said, just like you could say to a child, I'm sure they wouldn't have to be very old, you would say to them, make a sad face.
Exactly.
Or make a yucky face, like you just tasted something that just was the most awful thing, you know?
Yeah.
So he's got these pictures. Or think of something just really happy and just give me a big smile. And, you know, he took those pictures, things that, as I say, even a child would recognize. You'd say to them, you show them one of these things, and you say, tell me what's going on here. And if you show the sad face, the child is going to say, oh, that person is very sad, and then maybe they'll tell you a story about what's going on. So
that's
he
right.
took them, and he took them to a very different culture, and essentially he showed them the same pictures and said, okay, what's going on here? And the people, once they kind of caught on to the idea of what it was that was being asked about, they said exactly the same thing, that a smile is a smile and a yucky face is a yucky face, and that somebody is really mad, you can tell by their expression. And that he went on to say, you know, look, this is not about culture. There's something here that's hardwired that you see those expressions. Doesn't matter who you are, doesn't matter where you are, you know what that means.
Yeah, and you know, it's, I think we all intuitively believe that now, but at the time, that was a radical and revolutionary finding. And the second thing that Ekman did that your listeners will love, and it really sets the stage for his other line of work that led to the Fox show Lie to Me, mm-hmm. is Ekman then came back and he said, well, gosh, these emotions, this preliminary data suggests, are universal, how do we create a science to measure emotions, which are so subjective, right, and so personal and internal? He spent 7 years of his life figuring out how to code the movements of facial muscles by how those movements change the appearance of your face. And he developed this coding system that a lot of researchers like myself have learned. And from that coding system, we can then figure out, as I do in this book, what love looks like, what desire looks like, what compassion or embarrassment looks like in the face, and how they're part of our evolutionary story. Really a remarkable contribution.
Yeah, and the, what sort of makes this maybe a little bit more difficult, though, is that you, this is something that you kind of stumbled into because you were doing work for him that involves cataloging, doing this very tedious business of cataloging these expressions, very subtle things that happen very quickly, that you discovered something that, again, if you weren't consciously looking for it, you wouldn't see it. But if you know what to look for, suddenly you say, oh, this is very interesting, even though it can go by in the blink of an eye. We can take it in, but at some level that's maybe not quite conscious, unless, of course, you're trained to see that, like you were and other people who have studied his system.
Yeah, you know, terrific analysis. You know, what this system gives you is this lens into the super fast emotional behavior of our social lives that's been shaped by literally hundreds of millions of mammalian years of mammalian evolution. And so, you know, and it gives you this opportunity, which is so important in science, to discover things accidentally. I was coding, my journey really began when I was in Ekman's lab. I was coding the startle response. We startled people unexpectedly because the startle response, believe it or not, is one of the best ways to understand how tense and anxious a person is, according to how big their startle response is. And I was coding the startle response, 7 muscle movements that blaze by in half a second. It takes about an hour to code a minute of that behavior. And unexpectedly, didn't anticipate it, about half of the people who got startled showed this interesting display of embarrassment where they put their head down, they show their neck, they do this coy, sort of compressed smile. And then that led me to Darwin and to a whole evolutionary science of embarrassment that said, wow, this display of modesty and embarrassment looks just like mammalian appeasement displays and triggers peace and forgiveness when you've made mistakes. So that really, you know, that little accidental discovery, thanks to Paul Ekman, led to my work on a lot of these emotions. Mm.
We have some callers here. We'll get to them in just a second. As quickly as I introduce again our guest, Dacher Keltner. He's professor of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's director of the Greater Good Science Center and co-editor of Greater Good magazine. And his research work focuses on the evolutionary basis of pro-social emotions, things like compassion, awe, embarrassment, love. He is widely known as one of the leading scholars in the study of facial expression. He's written many papers, 2 best-selling textbooks, one on emotion and the other on social psychology, has done a lot of interviews and does a lot of talking about this work. And if you're interested in learning more about it, you should look at his book that's just been out now for a couple of weeks. The title of the book is Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life, and it's published by W.W. Norton. We have several callers here. We'll get back to our folks who are listening and start with line 1 in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Fascinating conversation you guys are having. And as I was listening, I was thinking, as we're talking from an evolutionary perspective on humanity, on the development of emotions, we're using words now that the pinnacle of evolution is compassion, is love, and empathy, and these very morally charged words that kind of have these, at least in my perspective, some religious connotations. And so I was wondering, you know, when you think religion, it's almost a contradiction, or at least the opposite side of the coin to think of evolution and Darwinian perspective from some camps. So exactly, I was wondering what was Darwin's some of his influences and his understandings of the perspective of religion and this whole scheme of human development in a society?
Well, you know, you always bump into the question when you talk about emotions like awe and reverence and compassion. You know, first the question of morality, right? And some people believe that evolution does not have a moral direction, just like economic markets are supposedly not supposed to have moral directions to them. But I think that there is a new view that's emerging, and it really starts with people like Robert Wright, the moral animal, that suggests that, look, you know, our moral capacities, if you want to call them moral capacities, of respect and modesty and not being greedy and empathy and treat thine neighbor as thyself, are really built into our nervous systems thanks to evolution. And so, you know, to give you an example, in my chapter on compassion, I write about this fascinating set of nerves in our body called the vagus nerve, which is loaded up with oxytocin receptors that make us trusting and generous. Science has just discovered this vagus nerve regulates our immune system, so being generous probably is good for your health. And it triggers when we see harm, right? And so we have this nerve in our body that says, wow, there's harm to someone who doesn't deserve it. I'll help and sacrifice. So I think evolutionists are coming to the view that, you know, although that doesn't tell us what should be moral within a particular culture, certainly we have been wired to have moral capacities like modesty, compassion, and respect. Darwin, you know, in his own thinking about this, I think really deeply contemplated you know, the conflict that he was going to create between an evolutionary account of our origins and Genesis accounts of our origins in Christianity, and it really bothered him. And the reason he did it was his wife was a devout Christian. And when she wrote Charles about writing The Origin of Species, she said, my greatest worry about this is that, your thinking doesn't allow for the afterlife where you and I can live in eternity together. And it's a very moving story. And Darwin really struggled with that thinking in his own thinking about our origins and how sympathy is a strong instinct. So it was very much on his mind. And I think just to round out this complicated discussion, the listener should really consult people like David Sloan Wilson and Elliot Sober and others who are saying that, you know, religions are universal. They're powerfully important to people's lives. They're amazing ways to bond people together. They may be some of our best ways to bond together. And they provide an evolutionary account of religions, which is they are ways to create cooperative groups.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. On to another caller. This is Urbana in line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Many years ago, I read some essays by Peter Kropotkin, the 19th century naturalist and political theorist. I'm just wondering, is anything from his work, the way I recall, he basically built upon Darwin, but he tried to change the paradigm from competition to cooperation.
Yeah.
Based upon his own study of nature, and I recall an essay where he talked about wolf packs in North America.
Yep.
And that the survival depends upon your ability to cooperate with the pack, not your individual, the length of your teeth and so on and so on. Is there anything that endures from Kropotkin? Is he in that line that goes from you back through your mentor to Darwin, or was he sort of an anomaly, had some interesting ideas, but ultimately not much of his work still stands?
Wow, what an astute and thoughtful question. So, you know, what's interesting about Darwin and the theory of evolution, and Adam Gopnik points this out in Angels and Ages, is that, you know, Darwin wrote a very, very rich description of human evolution, the evolution of different organisms like mollusks and worms and, you know. And out of that, people took it in many different directions in terms of their moral assumptions. You know, there were people who used that to justify social Darwinism. There were people who used that to justify libertarianism. And Kropotkin was somebody who used it to justify how communal we are and how cooperative we are and how deep our social collectives are. and how that runs in the grain of our nervous system. And I think I really appreciate your question, because I think that when I read a bit of Kropotkin earlier, I think I did resonate with his thinking that that we're an unusual mammal in how dependent we are on others. And he, a lot of his observations, if I remember correctly, were of mammals in very harsh environments where they did have to depend on each other. It's interesting, your reference to wolves, that because there's a vibrant new evolutionary scholarship of wolves and coyotes by Mark Beekhoff at Colorado, and he's showing, for example, that wolves have all these collective behaviors like rough and tumble play that they use to bond and to become strong groups. So I think there's a, you know, if I were a Darwinian historian, that would be a really good story to write about the return of Kropotkin in current thought.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, to another caller, this is someone in Champaign. This is line 3. Hello.
Yeah. What about the relationship of Gottman's work between, because I know he did coding.
Yeah.
You know, and actually could predict. I mean, divorces end up 50-50 anyway, but I think he was up in the 95% range. Does his work?
Oh, my God.
Was it a precursor to this?
No, well, Gottman, who was, I think, at the University of Illinois had a distinguished scientific career and also a career as a playwright there when he was a professor. John Gottman has revolutionized the study of marriage in large part by applying the wisdom of the emotions and Paul Ekman to the study of marriage. And, you know, people had a lot of trouble studying, figuring out what predicts difficulties in marriages and divorce and conflict and the like. So Gottman came along with Bob Levinson, who's my colleague here at Berkeley, and just looked at, he videotaped conversations between young couples and coded the emotions that they were showing in a 10-minute conversation. And what he discovered, as your listener nicely anticipates, is that if a couple shows, if both partners show defensiveness, if they shut each other down and they stonewall each other, if they criticize with a sharp edge, and if they show this real toxic emotion, contempt, 14 years later, there's a 92% chance that they divorce. That finding shook the world of the study of marriage. And I'm happy to say John Gottman is doing these marriage interventions now based on this new science of emotion and getting really good results. So the emotions are vital to our well-being and our social well-being.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, it makes me think about something here that you write about in the book, the fact that you were in contact with, or you were approached by a scholar that said, look, you know, I have this large body of longitudinal data about a group of people, a group of women, followed them over a long period of time. Would you be interested in just taking a look at what I have is from these women, I have all their college yearbook photos. Would you be interested in taking a look at their pictures, that picture, and looking at the facial expression, and then seeing if you can, you know, draw any connections, just knowing that, if you can say anything about what kind of life now, years and years later, this person is living?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, what a great segue. You know, one of the themes of Born to Be Good, this my new book, is that, you know, we've evolved these important emotions. We used to think that they were not really central to our well-being, and a lot of, for example, Greek thought advocated that, and Western thought. And now this new science of emotion, like John Gottman and Paul Ekman, is saying, my goodness, little one-second expressions can tell us whether a marriage is going to stay together or not. It's pretty remarkable. And that's because the emotions and the signs we see of emotion are deep statements about our intentions and our commitments and our interests in others. So I, you know, guided by that science, one day Ravenna Helfen came along, who's a distinguished professor here at Berkeley. She's 80 some odd years old and more productive than anybody in my department. Real inspiration. And she's been studying these women for now 50 years. It's the longest study of women's lives in the world. who graduated from Mills College in 1958-59. She came by and said, you know, you study expressions. I've got these yearbook photos. See what you can do. So we coded the warmth of the smiles of these yearbook photos. And the warmth of a smile simply reduces to two muscle movements in the Ekman tradition, the zygomatic major, which pulls the lip corners up, and then the orbicularis oculi, a muscle that surrounds the eye. And when that contracts, your cheek goes up, your lower eyelid pouches, and you get those horrible crow's feet that everyone wants to remove but are actually important signs of our happiness. And when you see that orbicularis oculi contract, you know the person's happy, their left side of the brain is active, which is more associated with happiness, a lot of good things. And what we found is that women with warmer smiles using that muscle around the eyes when they're 20, for the next 30 years, are less stressed out in their daily lives, they're more connected to other people, they are accomplishing their goals more proficiently, and this is the real kicker, they're happier in their own personal lives at age 50, and they're happier in their marriages. So that warm smile is a sign of the life well lived.
About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me introduce again the guest, Decker Keltner. He's professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, and his research focuses on pro-social emotions. And you can read about some of his work in the book Born to be Good, just out a couple of weeks now. It's published by Norton, W.W. Norton. Let's talk with another caller in Indiana. Toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello. As a possible sidebar, I wonder if you could make some comments about the historical acceptance of Darwin's view that there couldn't be a being that would exist that would let small children die, you know, in regards to his daughter. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's great to get these questions about Darwin, whose 200th birthday is quickly approaching on February 12th, born the same day as Lincoln. A great citizen of your area. So Darwin really struggled with the idea of religion and God, and started off really wanting to be a minister, struggled and sort of haphazardly ended up on the Beagle, and thought about this theory of evolution for 15, 20 years before really publishing it. And we've talked about how he struggled with the presence of God because of his thinking and how it contradicted his beloved wife's thinking. And Darwin was a beloved dad and a very actively engaged dad by all accounts and by his own diaries, and had 10 kids and played with them and loved them. And then, tragically, his favorite daughter, Annie, passed away from tuberculosis at age 10. And Darwin was there tending to her day and night, and it really, as Adam Gopnik in Angels and Ages says, other historians or biographers, it devastated Darwin. He fell into a depression. He wrote a beautiful eulogy for her, and he locked it up. He couldn't even go to her funeral. He was so destroyed. And what it led him to was a couple of things. One is he lost faith in God at that moment and a natural theology, I think, that where how could a God be around that would let that happen? And then it led him, it really was an impetus in his thinking of evolution, because it made him think about what death does to which species and which kinds of individuals survive. So it was an engine of his evolutionary thought, and it was a real complicator for his religious thought. Hmm.
We're coming to the point here. We have about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And I wish that we could go further, but, you know, that's what we got. So given that some of the things we've been talking about, and particularly the person who raised the question about religion, I want to make sure that we talk about Jen, which is really where you start out.
Yeah. Well, you know, David, here's the thing, you know, there's an amazing new science of happiness and well-being, and it's really one of the central players is a person in your neck of the woods, Ed Diener at the University of Illinois.
Absolutely.
And we have made remarkable new discoveries about happiness which we're all interested in. Our Declaration of Independence considers the pursuit of happiness a right. And 250, 300 studies later, we now know money influences your happiness a little. What matters the most, the single most important factor is the quality of your relationships and the power of the emotions that make you have healthy relationships. Emotions like gratitude and laughter and modesty and love and kindness, which I write about in the book. And in my evolutionary analysis of these emotions and thinking about how they help us lead good lives, I had trouble finding an idea that united the core direction of an emotion like compassion with play, with modesty and respect. And so I turned to Confucius. I've always been interested in Eastern thought. And Confucius has this amazing treatment at the center of his thinking 2,500 years ago of Jen, J-E-N, or sometimes spelled R-E-N. And Jen is respect and kindness toward others. In Confucius's words, a person of Jen brings the good in others to completion and does not bring the bad in others to completion. And I thought that that was the motivation that really united these emotions I study and really maybe the simplest, most direct path to happiness.
And you set out this idea, you say you can construct a measure of Jen, and it's the kind of thing that you could do for a person and, or you could do for a society. And in a sense, what you're saying is, you know, assign some sort of value to the tendency to bring out the good or bring out the bad, and you can set that up and actually make a little mathematical calculation and say, okay, how's your I'll tell you your Gen score. I'll tell you what you're what you're doing and whether you're working on bringing out the good or bringing out the bad, or in fact, in a society, what's the tendency as a way of sort of measuring what people are doing and in which direction we're going.
Yeah, you know, well, I hope terrific question. You know, I hope the listeners now appreciate I have this pathology for quick measures, right? Thanks to you know, smiles and yearbook photos and laughs and bereavement and little modest blushes that help us connect to others. And I was thinking, you know, to give the reader, like, what is a, you know, Darwin and Ekman gave me personally a lens onto how to think about well-being in my life. And how could I describe that, you know, as I look out on a child's playground or, you know, soccer game or the family reunion. And I was so moved by this idea of Jen that I said, well, what about a Jen ratio or a Jen score? Mm-hmm. And the very simple idea is that in the top part of that ratio, you put all the ways in which you brought out the good in others. In the bottom, put all the ways in which you brought out the bad. This honors Jen and Confucius. And you get a score. And the more frequently you're bringing out the good, the bigger the score. And I think that may even be a better way to think about your well-being and the well-being of others than simply asking, am I happy?
Yeah. Well, and I don't want to mean to trivialize you or your work, and certainly the book Born to Be Good is a book for a general reader. It's not a textbook. It's not just for other psychologists. It's for people to read. And I do also want to make sure people understand that in addition to sort of making this argument about why it is we should have these kind of pro-social emotions and why they would be positive in an evolutionary sense, that you do also spend some time thinking about how it is they actually came to be, which is a more complicated and maybe a little bit more interesting kind of argument that going past the point of saying, okay, there are good things. But let's think about, well, how is it something like the smile, for example?
Right.
Where does that come from? Why do we do it? How did it develop?
Yeah, you know, and when you ask, you know, the why question takes us back deep in time, right, and think mm-hmm. about our evolutionary mm-hmm. past. The how question is really almost an ethical question, which is, how do these emotions enable social well-being and healthy relationships right now, in the moment? And the book really charts how all of these emotions, like laughter and play and reverence and respect, and help us in the moment. You know, one of the you talk about the smile, and what is clear from the literature on the smile, which I review, is as we move around in our social lives, really warm smiles that we send off to other people make other people trust us. They calm them down physiologically. They bring out the good in others and make them happier just by a warm smile. Another great example, which touches upon an amazing science right now, is touch. You know, if we're to evolve as a cooperative species and have cooperative groups, we need fast-acting displays that promote goodness and cooperation in others. And touch, just warmly touching somebody on the back, activates reward centers in the brain, makes people trust and be generous. You know, students who are patted on the back are twice as likely to speak out in class. Young girls who are warmly touched by their parents are more confident at school. There's another way, really the how question of how we came to be more cooperative through these emotions I talk about.
Yeah, and that's, I think, just it is a way of finishing up. I think that also has something to say to parents who are interested in fostering these kinds of emotions in their children. And it's and certainly I would sure hope that all parents would.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, our center, Greater Good Science Center, has a blog called Half Full, where we have a, you know, PhD in sociology, who's the director of our center as well, who writes about how to get parents to move away from this extreme busyness and competitiveness of our culture toward, you know, the kinds of great community-based activities and emotions that promote healthier kids.
Well, for people who want to explore this further, and there is much more in this book, I would suggest you look for the book. It's titled Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Just been out a couple of weeks now, published by W.W. Norton, by our guest, Dacher Keltner. He's professor of psychology at UC Berkeley. He's director of the Greater Good Science Center and co-editor of Greater Good magazine. And Professor Keltner, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you, David. It's been a great conversation.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archives. Many of our past shows, along with interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and many local news features, are available on our website anytime that you are ready to listen. Just go to WILL, that's will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com.
Good morning. It's 3 minutes before noon Central Time. I'm Celeste Quinn. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with a philosopher. His name is J.D. Trout. We'll talk with him about his new book, The Empathy Gap. Why do we so often fall short in caring for ourselves and others? Could we do better? Well, to the second question, Trout says we can do much better. In his new book, he explains how we could use the latest findings in psychology, behavioral economics, and neuroscience to improve human well-being. J.D. Trout will be our guest at 1:06 this afternoon. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat, $5.74.5, up 13.5. March wheat in Chicago, $5.16, up 17.25. May, $5.25, up 16.75. March corn, $3.71.25, up 15.25. May, $3.79, up 14.5. July, $3.89, up 14.5. September, $3.97.5, up 13.75. March beans, $8.84, up 9. May, $8.77, up 15. July, $8.76.5, up 15.75. March meal, $2.85 even, up $3.70. March oil, $29.70, up 6. Livestock contracts. April live cattle, $83.95, up $1.40. June, $82 even, up $1.05. March feeder cattle, $91.20, up $1.20. April, $91.85, up $1.50. April lean hog, $62 even, up $1.67.5. Outside markets, April crude, $44 even, up $1.67. The U.S. dollar, $88.09, that is up $45. The CRB index, $206.32. Up 282. The Dow currently up 141 at 7,071. The NASDAQ is up 28 at 1399. The S&P 500 up 17 points at 738. This is WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Media at Illinois. It's 27 degrees in Urbana on the campus of the University of Illinois at noon Central Time. Mike Solis forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon. In the south, mostly cloudy with a few snow showers and flurries. Elsewhere,